Well, thank you for the opportunity to give this talk. I'm hearing quite an echo. Okay, now it is better. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about part of my work that I've been doing over the past 6 years, approximately, with quite a few collaborators, which is on the use of the functional renormalization group as an approach to find possible continuum limits for or candidate continuum limits in tensor models that would be candidates for quantum gravity. So when you, I like to show this slide. When we're talking about quantum gravity, we're really, unlike many other areas of physics, we're really in uncharted territory, and we know that there is some missing piece in our description of nature, because on the one hand we have general relativity and on the other hand we have quantum field theories, but we don't know how to combine them into a unified framework. So there is definitely some missing piece in our understanding of nature. There may be many more that we don't know about, but at least there's a strong hint. So we're looking for a theory that explains both quantum field theory, or where quantum field theory comes out as one limit, and where general relativity comes out as a different limit, or as a classical limit of this theory. And this search has been going on for 80 years about, and many approaches have been proposed for this. And what we see is, well, what we see is that the simplest ideas that worked for quantum field theories that we use, for example, in the standard model, perturbative techniques, they don't work for general relativity. So we have to put the very concept of quantum field theories on particular feet. We have to establish precise frameworks and try to build a theory of quantum gravity from scratch. So many people at Perimeter is a perfect place for this, because people work on many distinct approaches, and most of you have worked on more than one approach to quantum gravity. Most of the people who are at Perimeter have worked on more than one approach. So you know this dilemma that certain approaches have, one approach may have one built-in feature, something that just works by construction, by the basic assumption and by the basic constructions that you have. But then you hit certain roadblocks, and they are, so you hit certain difficulties, and they are inherent features of other approaches. So the idea is, well, we should combine the benefits of more than one approach, and in a certain sense, using renormalization group techniques and tensor models could be viewed as in this spirit, to use the advantages of the renormalization group to investigate state sum models for discrete quantum gravity. So let me give you a quick outline of my talk. I will basically review in the first part, I will review some foundations on matrix and a little bit on tensor models. I won't say so much in the first part about that. Then I will explain why I use the functional renormalization group for that, and what is the non-trivial part, which is setting up the functional renormalization group with certain symmetries, respecting certain symmetries that we want to implement because of fundamental principles, because we want to use it to construct a state sum model for geometry. Then I will apply this framework that I will just the functional normalization group framework. I will apply this and show results in matrix models, because they are really benchmarks for this type of setup. And then I will talk about more recent work on where we applied this to color tensor models. And at the end, I will give a summary. So all of this is based on a lot of work that I've been doing with Astrid Eichhorn over the past 6 years, and then with various other collaborators, for example, Joseph Bencheloun, Antonio Pereira, Daniele Oriti, Johannes Luma, and I'm also referring, I will also refer to two parts of that are still unpublished. One is a paper with Alicia Castro that we're working on, and another one is with Victor Munoz, that I will also tangentially mention what we've been doing in this work. So let's start, and let's review the basics. So I said we want to implement the continuum limit, or we want to investigate the continuum limit for lattice quantum gravity. So we want to consider a state sum of something that is a quantum gravity action, and we sum over all geometries, and we give them a Boltzmann factor, and that is the state sum that we want to approach. Well, what it turns out is that you can do this in two dimensions, and this has been known for a very long time, for over 40 years, that you can do this with matrix models. So here I do the simplest I use the simplest approach. I use a real matrix model. So I have the matrix A and its transpose, and this model is invariant under certain symmetry. I can do a left rotation and a right rotation of the matrix A, and this action that I wrote there is invariant under the action of a left rotation and the right rotation, simply because I always have A transpose, A is transposed, and then cyclically repeated. So now if you have this, if you have a setup like that, then you have these matrices, and you can represent them graphically, and you say, I denote matrices by these dots here, by these white dots, and I denote the left index by a red line and the right index of the matrix by a blue line, and then you get this blue, red graph that I drew on the right-hand side here for this interaction term. And now you see that this interaction term, you can dualize it, and this is well known. This has been well known. You can dualize it to a triangulation of a, in this case of a square. If you had more matrices, you would have a higher polygon, a triangulation of a higher polygon. And now you look at the partition function. So you look at the integral over all matrices and do give them a Boltzmann factor, or the Euclidean partition function, e to the minus s of this matrix. And then, well, in the first step, you just say, well, I expand that in a Feynman graph expansion. This is what I write as this sum over gamma, and I sum over the amplitude of gamma. And then I say, well, but I can view these graphs, gamma, as triangulations of two-dimensional geometries in the case of matrix models. And how comes this about? Well, what it turns out is when you have a matrix model with A transpose as the quadratic term, or with any quadratic term, you can, the Feynman diagrams are the vertices, are these diagrams, these cyclic diagrams that I drew here, and then you just have to contract these vertices with propagators, which are indicated by dashed lines here. And then you have a very simple dual interpretation of this, which is this thing, which is this diagram on the right-hand side, where I just give an interpretation. You say this Feynman diagram, where I have this one propagator and two vertices, this corresponds to the gluing of two of these squares along the edge that is indicated by the propagator, by the dashed line. And so now I have this, but now I have an interpretation of this Boltzmann factor as the logarithm of an amplitude, as e to the minus the logarithm of this Feynman amplitude that I get from the matrix model action. And then you can ask, is there a geometric interpretation? And in the simplest case, and in the case that I drew here, there is a geometric interpretation. And so what I mean with that is that you can write it just in terms of the geometry of the triangulation that occurs in the Feynman diagram expansion. And when you inspect it, you find that it's of the form of the Ricci action. So you have a coupling constant that goes with the number of d simplices and a coupling constant that goes with the number of d minus 2 simplices. And you recognize that as the Ricci action, or the discrete Einstein-Hilbert action. And there is a relation between, pardon me? And then there is a really.
There was no question. Sorry, go on.
Okay, and then there is a relation between these coupling constants of that appear in the Ricci action here, and the coupling constants in the matrix model. So there is the matrix coupling constant, and then there is this factor n here, which is the size of the matrix. Which is the size of the matrix. And at the end, what it turns out, what I will argue on the next slide, is that if you want to take the continuum limit of this of the gravity action, then it corresponds to holding the volume fixed and taking the expectation value for the d simplices to infinity. Which means that you make a finer at fixed volume. You make the physical size of the building blocks finer and finer. And when a goes exactly to zero, you have the continuum limit. Well, in the case of when the matrix size goes to infinity, then the Newton constant vanishes, and this is so you. So it turns out, if you naively send n to infinity, you get a trivial path integral. So you're not approaching the Einstein-Hilbert action. So if you want to obtain a finite value for Newton's constant in the continuum limit, then you have to use a critical scaling of g. So you have to scale g as a function of matrix size, just in such a way that in the limit where you send n to infinity, Newton's constant remains a constant, is non-zero. But that just means that you have to find a critical scaling, because this is precisely what you want for a critical scaling of the matrix model itself. And so we start, if we want to have a geometric continuum limit, then we need by construction we need to find critical points of this matrix model. So I mentioned that matrix models were used for a long time, and they can serve as a blueprint. Their success can serve as a blueprint of what you want to do in higher dimensions. And in fact, even the use of renormalization group techniques goes back to the early 1990s. I have here, I'm citing a paper by Sinchastin and a paper by Ayala, from the early 1990s, where a Hermitian matrix model for quantum gravity, it has an analogous geometric interpretation. It's just that this Hermitian model triangulates space in terms of triangles, and the model, the real model that I presented, triangulates the space in terms of rectangles. And with these early matrix, with these early approaches to matrix models, in these two papers, it was found that you can reproduce some of the analytic results of the matrix model approach to quantum gravity. In particular, you can find this. Pardon me?
There was no question. Please go.
Okay. So then I just heard my echo. So this is the important scaling limit. So this is important critical scaling of g of n has been found. This behavior has been found analytically before, and the critical exponent has been found to be a 4/5, so 0.8. In the 1970s and early 80s, there was one found the existence of a whole tower of multi-critical points, whose matrix model action are more complicated actions with more than one coupling constant, and they can be interpreted as quantum gravity coupled to matter. For example, if you have the first multi-critical point, so where you have two critically scaling couplings in your action, then you can interpret this as a hard dimer. Basically, you have a smaller building block and a larger building block, and you consider the larger building block as the smaller building block once glued together. And this edge that they are glued together, this is where the matter sits, where the matter resides in this model, and that is the location of the hard dimer in the geometric interpretation. And there is a whole tower of these multi-critical points that are all of this sort. So those are benchmark results, and in these papers in the early 90s, they were done by explicitly integrating out the degrees of freedom of the matrices and then rescaling the matrix model action. They found hints to get to this critical exponent 4/5, that there is a continuum limit with a critical exponent 4/5 for pure gravity model, and they also found hints for the multi-critical points. But what appears from the literature, what was a problem there is that you could not get, at least with those methods, with explicitly integrating out and doing the rescaling by hand, you could not get numerically accurate critical exponents. So this is what we set out to do when about 6 or 7 years ago, Astrid and I started to work on using the functional renormalization group. We wanted to be able to calculate this better. We wanted to actually be able to calculate this 4/5 as a benchmark result. We wanted to get numerical precisions, so real control over the multi-critical points and over the critical exponents that you find there. And we could then gain experience how to do this for higher dimensional models, how to do this for tensor models for quantum gravity. So when you take a small step back, then what we really want to do is we want to define a measure for this matrix model. For this matrix model or for the tensor model, so that has certain symmetries. So when we go back to this action here, for this action to have this geometric interpretation, one part that is important for that you glue only left indices to left indices, so you glue only along red edges and blue edges, and you glue only along propagators. You have to satisfi this bi-orthogonal symmetry so that you can rotate A by the left with one rotation and by the right with a different rotation. So this is important to have. It is important that your model has this symmetry. But then mathematically, you just want to find a tensor model that has this desired symmetry, where you can take the large n limit, where you can take the limit, the continuum limit, n to infinity to get to the continuum limit of the tensor model, of the associated quantum gravity model. So if you think about it in these abstract terms, then there is a basic tool that those of you who have worked on loop quantum gravity certainly know. And this is when you want to construct a measure on an infinite dimensional space, you basically have to implement cylindrical consistency. So let me explain what that means. Well, if you have a measure on an infinite dimensional space, this measure on the infinite dimensional space induces a measure for all functions, for all cylindrical functions on its finite subspaces. So what do I want to say with this? Well, if I have a function that just depends on one or two or a small or finite number of degrees of freedom of this infinite dimensional space, then I can, and if this function is integrable, that is of course a question whether it is, but let's suppose it is integrable, then the infinite dimensional measure defines a measure on this set of finite dimensional on this finite dimension, and it reduces to a measure on the finite dimensional space. And so the infinite dimensional measure induces the cylindrical measures on the finite dimensional subspaces. But these induced finite dimensional measures, they're not independent, but they satisfy consistency relations of the type that I wrote here. So if you have a function f of u that just depends on a finite dimensional subspace u, then I can express it on this space u as a function fu, or I can express it on a space that is larger, that contains u and some larger space. This is what I just wrote here as uv. And then the consistency relation is, of course, they're both obtained by integrating two of these representative functions over the same infinite dimensional measure. So the left-hand side, when I integrate over the larger space, and the right-hand side, when I integrate over the smaller space, when I use the same function, they have to give the same result. So now this way of going about things is obvious. What is remarkable is that the other way is also possible, and it's a theorem that you can that if you have a set of cylindrical measures, so if you have cylindrical sets that approach the full infinite dimensional space, when you make them larger and larger, as you include more and more into these cylindrical sets, and you have a set of measures on each one of them that satisfies a pairwise these consistency relations that I wrote here, then you have already defined a cylinder. Then you have already defined a measure on the infinite dimensional space, and basically what you have to show to prove that it's a measure is that convergence implies convergence of the integral, so convergence of the Cauchy sequence that do approximation functions converge converge towards the integral. So now, if we have taken back several steps to the mathematical problem, so abstractly, I said, well, we can if we can find a measure that has certain symmetries, like in the matrix model case, or as we will in the second part of the talk, as we will talk about tensor models, then I want to then I can construct then I can construct a candidate for then I can construct a candidate for quantum gravity theory if I construct a cylindrical measure for on this with this symmetry. And basically the program that I wrote down here, this would fill an entire talk if I fleshed it out in its detail, but it's basically you take these you take these consistency relations and you see them as just integrating out here over the V part, and that induces a new measure on the smaller space. And that is really the essence of the cylindrical consistency relations. And now you can do this, this integrating out, this integrating over the variable V in this for, in this equation up here. And you can say, well, I don't do this in one step, but I do it in a piecemeal way. I use an interpolator from an initial point where I integrate over all of V and I don't suppress it to a point where I completely suppress the variable V. So I just get an integral over U. And this can be done by giving a Gaussian suppression factor and setting up an interpolation formula. And you can do this explicitly. And if you do that with a Gaussian suppression factor, then you get a renormalization group equation of the Polchinski type for the effective action. So for the representation of this measure mu here as an exponential times a Lebesgue measure on some finite dimensional vector space. And then, and this is something that has been shown in the also in the early 90s, then you can do the Legendre transform of this Polchinski equation, and this was done by Tim Morris in, I think, in 94. And you get an equation for the effective action, so for the generating function, for all the cumulants of the partition function. And you get a Wetterich type flow equation, so you get the functional renormalization group equation. Now, for doing physics, it is for various reasons practically much easier to use these Wetterich type equations than the Polchinski equations. And so this was the approach that we took here. So usually when you take the functional renormalization group equation, you can motivate it in by itself, that you use a partition function and you write it as an integral over some bare action with some UV cutoff, some bare action, and some IR suppression term with some scale-dependent mass term that does this interpolation that I just talked about. And then you change the scale k of this IR suppression factor here, that of this quadratic mass term, of the scale-dependent mass term that I put here by hand, and you obtain a flow equation for the effective average action. So for the generator of all Green's functions. So now, of course, if you you expect that you can do exactly the same thing for tensor models and for quantum gravity, or for matrix models for quantum gravity, but the first question when you try to set this up practically, when you try to do this practically, is what kind of suppression factor do you have to choose to get the to get the correct interpolation property? And that was actually something where at first we did some guesses, and fortunately we did the right guesses, but there is a systematic way to get to which RK you have to use. And this is precisely by going through the logical program that I set out here, that you say, well, what you really want to ensure is this, is the cylindrical consistency relations between the finite dimensional subspaces. You do, you put this into a Polchinski type flow equation, and then you do the Legendre transform of that equation. And then you get the same equation as Wetterich's equation, viewing it from implementing cylindrical consistency. What you usually do when you look at Wetterich's equation is you say, well, we have a physical interpretation when we take this scale, this IR suppression scale to infinity, so we give all modes a very large mass term, then basically something that is a large mass term in this exponential here basically approaches a delta function, and then you do a saddle point expansion around this delta function, and you see that when you send k to the UV cutoff, and you make an approximation in, you make an expansion in 1 over lambda of around the saddle point that you get from this delta function, then you see that in the UV, when k goes to infinity, you approach the Baer action with renormalized coupling constants. And in the IR, you give none of the terms, none of the degrees of freedom a mass term. So this extra mass term drops out, and you get the generating function of the one particle irreducible Green's function. So you get basically the encoding of the entire quantum theory, or of all the cumulants of your partition function. So these two limits are a very good practical reason why this interpretation is a very good practical reason to use the functional renormalization group approach, because you have now this interpolation property that gives you physical insight into what is going on in the with your path integral. So what do you need when you want to use the functional renormalization group equation, or any kind of exact renormalization group equation? Well, what you need is you need a space of fundamental UV actions, and what you want is to find possible continuum limits in this space of UV actions, and you find the generic IR behavior, which we know is the universal behavior of the renormalization group flow, that many different high energy theories at a finite cutoff, they all in the infrared become indistinguishable. What you need to do this is you need a notion of scale separation. In the case of the Wetterich equation, it's encoded in this scale-dependent IR suppression term, in this scale-dependent mass term. And this is really what implements how we go about disintegrating out of degrees of freedom, or in which order we want to satisfy the cylindrical a part of the cylindrical consistency relations. Then what we also need is a theory space, which is the space of admissible action functionals. So we need So this means that we need to say, what are these fields? What degrees of freedom do I integrate over? And what are the symmetries that I impose on the bare action? So this we already have from the geometric interpretation that we want to put on this system. And then if we want to do a practical calculation, we also, we cannot, in practice, we cannot work with a functional of fields, so this gamma of phi, but we want to reduce this to its relevant part, so to a manageable ansatz for the effective action. So this means we have to do a truncation ansatz, and we have to project this renormalization group flow that I have, that we calculate using the functional renormalization group equation. We have to be able to project it onto this truncation. So now one thing that I mentioned is that that the symmetries of the bare action or of this theory space are important for the geometric interpretation, and that this is quite an important step is to implement this symmetry. But if we go back to this matrix model action, so this is invariant under orthogonal rotations from the left to the right. So all matrix elements of the matrix A are created equal because I can rotate any one into any other matrix element. So unitary symmetry doesn't allow that I split the matrix degrees of freedom into some that I want to integrate out and some others that I don't want to integrate out as of now. So the presence of this IR suppression term necessarily breaks the symmetry of the bare action. And well, if we think about how to implement symmetries in the realm of path integrals, we do this usually through word identities that are satisfied by the effective action. And so in this case, when we have a scale dependent mass term, the scale dependent IR suppression term, then these word identities will depend on this scale here. So let me explain what I mean by that. Let's say we have some symmetry operation that we can do, and that is a symmetry of the bare action. And let's say it is of this form that I write here. So I do some infinitesimal symmetry transformation of the bare action, and then I get some infinitesimal variation that is proportional to these parameters here. Now, for simplicity, I will suppose that the measure that I write, the cutoff measure, so this is just a Lebesgue measure that is invariant under the symmetry. And then going through these steps, through the definition of the partition function, I find that do the Legendre transform, then I find that the effective average action, where I have the presence of the scale-dependent mass term, is not invariant under this, but that it has this symmetry breaking term that basically is the variation of the scale-dependent mass term under this under the symmetry transformation. But so what this word identity does is that it singles out a surface in this theory space, in this space of all action functionals, where it's satisfied. These are the symmetric actions. And now because this word identity depends on this scale k, this means that this that these surfaces where the word identities are satisfied, that they evolve as I lower the scale k, as I go along the renormalization group flow. But what it turns out is that they don't change in an arbitrary way, but in a very particular way. Basically, they behave like a composite operator. They scale like a composite operator, like precisely as the scale dependent mass term. And that means that if I satisfy the word identity at some scale k, then I can just study the renormalization group flow, and I will always satisfy it. And that is very handy, because that way we don't have to satisfy the word identity we don't have to correct for the symmetry after each renormalization group steps. We just have to find a suitable initial condition. And then by the interpolation property that in the limit where you take k to zero, where the IR suppression scale goes to zero, you get to the physical effective action of this system. This implies then that in this case, your effective action, your gamma at k equals zero, the quantum effective action of the theory satisfies the usual word identity that is not broken by the regulator term. And that is really what we wanted to implement to begin with. So now how let's do this in the matrix model case to start with. So we take the a Hermitian matrix model like I do here, or what it turns out where the calculations are a lot simpler are in the real matrix model where you have this M transpose, as I had on one of my first slides. So now there, as I already said, the action is invariant under these bi-orthogonal transformations. So we get a theory space, a space of where we can expand all action functionals in terms of a trace of invariants that are invariant under these transformations. And those are traces of M transposed to some power, some integer power. So the theory space that we get for this type of matrix model is that it's an arbitrary scale dependent, that the effective average action is an arbitrary scale dependent function that depends on these traces m squared, m fourth, m six, and so on. But now what I have to do is I have to introduce a notion of scale separation. I have to say which degrees of freedom of the matrix I want to integrate out first. And so you can do something really arbitrary at this point, but what turns out to be very useful is to invent a Laplacian and just say, well, if I look at the matrix component AB, then I just define my Laplacian as being the value of the matrix indices summed up times the matrix itself, or times the matrix element itself. And if you do that, then you see that the upper left part of the matrix has low eigenvalues of the Laplacians, and the lower right part has the large eigenvalues. So you integrate out columns and rows from the lower right upwards to the upper left part of the matrix when you use this notion of scale separation. And a particular scale-dependent mass term that does that for you is to take a lithium type cutoff. So you just take theta of the Laplacian minus the scale n that you put in, and you multiply that by its argument, and To be able to remove the wave function renormalization at the end, you also multiply that with the wave function normalization. So if you do that, then you have the entire setup for the matrix model, and this turns out to be the correct way to do it. Although when we first did it, we just guessed that we can use this type of regulator and did the calculation. It was only later when we ran into problems how to generalize this to tensor models that we went through this program and saw that there is really a systematic way that forces you to use this sort of regulator, in particular, that forces you to use this type of scaling of the indices, that you divide the indices always by the total matrix size. Now, the first problem that you would encounter in the matrix model that you cannot simply guess is the dimension of the effective operators. Now, when you have a certain bare action, like I wrote here, I have a trace mm and a trace m to the third, then the trace m to the third has to be normalized by square root of n, or if I have a trace m to the fourth, the coupling constant has to be scaled by n to get a geometric continuum limit, and this just comes from the dualization process of Feynman amplitudes, and that and you find that you need to take the scaling. But now when you integrate out and you look at effective actions that come out of this, then you get effective coupling constants for all these functionals. For all these couplings that can appear here, for all these terms, traces of m to the n and arbitrary products of those, so you need to know how to scale those effective coupling constants. So I wrote here a particular ansatz for the effective action. So I just expand the effective action in monomials that are trace m to the n1, a trace m to the m2, and so on, until I go trace to the m to the 2ni in this manner. And when you already dictated the scaling of the trace g to the m4 coupling constants, then you see that this dictates you already how you have to scale all the other coupling constant if you impose that the beta functions admit a 1 over n expansion for all of the other coupling constants. And this is just due to the fact that the scaling of g to the fourth appears on the right-hand side of all these coupling constants. And on the other hand, for example, g to the 6 and 2 g to the 4th and so on, they appear on the right-hand side of g to the 4th. So you have only very little wiggle room if you impose that all of these, all of the beta functions at the same time admit a 1 over n expansion. So why do I want a 1 over n expansion? Well, I need that because I want to have something where I can take the limit n to infinity at the end. But this is, of course, only possible if this doesn't diverge when I take n to infinity. So just by this requirement, we find that the coupling constants have to scale in this particular manner. So basically that each trace has to scale with one of the with one n, with one times the matrix size, and each pair of matrices has to scale as to scale with one extra. And then it's convenient to subtract one from that, because that makes that the Gaussian integral is dimensionless. So actually, I said a little bit too much here, because what we find is we have never been able to prove that this is the only way to scale. But what you find is that if you have G4, if you fix the scaling of G4 to be the one required by geometry, and you make this ansatz, then you can show analytically that this will always be, just from graphical arguments, that all the beta functions will admit a 1 over n expansion. So then we go, then we do practically the matrix model calculation. So we use standard techniques that are analogous to what you do in continuum field theory, what has been, where a lot of work has been done using functional renormalization group equation, the functional renormalization group equation and other types of renormalization group equations. And I won't go into too much detail here, but when we, I will just present you the results. So if we start out with a truncation, where we make an ansatz for the effective action that we include only the single trace operators, and I give them now the scale, and I give them the scaling that I imposed before, then we can analytically calculate the large n limit of the beta functions, and it turns out to be this multinomial expansion of all the smaller at gn's. So they're all coupled to one another, and what we find with that is there are fixed points with one relevant direction. But when we calculate the critical exponent for this fixed point with one relevant direction, then we find a critical exponent that is of the order that is 1 plus minus about 10%. But this is still about 20% of the analytic value. Although we make a very general ansatz, we include all single trace operators. So this is already a truncation that includes an infinite number of coupling constants. Well, when we first found that, we were disappointed because this was only a little bit better than the results that we had set out to beat at the beginning. So these results by Saint-Justin and Ayala from the early 90s. And we started asking, why is that? And well, the first thing you can try is you can say, well, it's still just a truncation, and we may have missed some important operators, some operators that have been that should have been in the truncation. So we included double trace, and later we also included triple trace operators in the truncation. But it turned out that it actually didn't improve the critical exponent. In fact, it made it a little bit worse than the single trace truncation. The estimated values for the critical exponents for the double scaling limit. And at that point, it was still a little bit better than the integrating out and rescaling by hand approach, but it was disappointing that we had this discrepancy here. And what we then realized is what I already mentioned, is that we hadn't respected the symmetry of the model. We hadn't taken into account the word identity that implements the geometric interpretation of our model. So in this case, we have the an ON word identity, or a UN word identity, or an ON cross ON word identity. depending on the precise details of the model. But as I showed before, they are all of the form of this form here, of the form that you have some, you do the transformation to the effective action. And the transformation of the effective action is not zero, but it is some something that is, that looks like the Wetterich equation itself, and gives you basically the vacuum expectation value of the variation of the regulator. And so what this means is that if you start out with a completely symmetric ansatz for the effective action, then you cannot satisfy, then this part is zero, but this part is non-zero in general, unless you're unless you're in a Gaussian theory, and so you can never satisfy the ordered entities, and that is the technical reason why we hit this roadblock, or why we hit this block of the inaccuracy of the critical exponents. Well, once we understood that, we knew what to do. We needed to do calculations that respect the symmetry. And one thing that is a lazy man's trick, that you could say we were being lazy, is you realize that if you do a tadpole approximation to this second term here, then this second term vanishes always. So if we just consider one vertex diagrams in this approach, then this second term vanishes. So we said, well, then let's do this and include only and do a systematic expansion of this, where we do an expansion in the number of vertices that we do in this. And then at the first order, we have already a self-consistent solution to this. And then at the second order, we may have to include a new operator that helps us satisfy the ordered entity. But let's see where we get with that. And then we found, then we looked at the first order system, the one where we don't have to include new operators, and we found that for all multicritical exponents, we find very good accuracy already in the range of 1% from the analytic values, except for the double scaling limit for the first one of these, where we find one as a limit, and then all the multicritical exponents were already good. And then we used this first order approximation, and we applied it to multitrace operators, and we included them in our truncation. And then we found when the truncation was large enough that we got arbitrarily close to the multicritical exponent. So we got sub 1% to the analytic values of this of the critical exponents. So this indicates that so this was only the first step of implementing the symmetry, and already with the first approach you got very good results. There is one caveat with that, and that is that if you look at the pure double scaling limit, and that has a which contains a quantum the pure quantum gravity without any matter, then this critical exponent still turned out to be one, and this is due to a truncation artifact, and that is in this approximation there's only a small number of coupling constants, only the G4, the dg4, dg6, and dg22 can be turned on in this setting, and all others have to vanish. And this is why you get by analytic reasons you can only get the value 1 here. But this is only an artifact that is due to the fact that the truncation is by construction in this at this first order approach really small. So now let me talk in the
just to let you know, we are slowly running out of time, so
okay, so then let me go faster about this part. So I went over a lot of detail for the matrix model, but you can do the same thing for tensor models. And basically you have you take tensors that have colored bipartite graphs or colored graphs in the real case, and again these colored graphs admit a dual geometric interpretation and that are now triangulations by, in the case of a rank 3 tensor, by tetrahedra, in the rank D tensor by desymplices, and the Feynman graphs admit a geometric interpretation in terms of how to glue these desymplices together. And one thing that will turn out to colors are very important for the fact that you have a geometric interpretation, but what it also turns out, what is important, is that colors allow you to define a notion of faces which are closed two colored subgraphs. So what I did here in this graph here is I used this invariant, this 4-point invariant, and I wrote the 1, 2, 3, 4 faces of this graph, of this invariant, and I wrote the 1, 2, 3 faces of the second graph, of the crust diagram and of the cyclic melodic diagram. So it is something that contains, so the number of faces at a given number of fields and connected components of the diagram gives you information about the topology of the diagram. And now you can do this. Now it became important for us to understand how do we do this scaling. In the case of matrix models, we were still able to basically directly attack the beta functions and the 1/n expandability of the beta functions, and we could guess this ansatz for the scaling of the coupling constants. But in the case of tensor models, it wasn't clear what the functional renormalization group equation would dictate us. So this was the point where we had to go through the entire construction. What is the really fundamental principle that we want? And what you find is that a priori, you could define a theory space arbitrarily with an arbitrary assignment of scaling dimensions for the effective operators, but almost all assignments of these dimensions would not admit a 1/n expansion for the beta functions. And then of the remaining ones, a large number would just collapse to the Gaussian model in the large n limit. Basically, you would suppress the interaction terms too much with powers of n. So there is only a very small window for this scaling, where you get a non-trivial scaling. And then there is a third point that is important here, is that one can always remove the overall scaling of the fields by a redefinition of the fields or of the integration variable of the integral. So we can always choose the Gaussian term to be dimensionless by this field redefinition. And so, and then usually when we want a geometric interpretation, then we have one interaction term. And this interaction term has to have a certain scaling with n, with the size of the tensor, with the size of the tensor indices of this index space. And that already is the seed for the 1 over n expandability. Now what we can do is we can just if we have an idea, if we have a particular formula for the scaling dimension, and we can just check whether the whether this scaling admits a 1 over n expansion. And this can be done, for example, for the pure complex model, where we give a 1 over n squared scaling to all these cyclic melons that are of this form that I wrote here. So if I assume this, then we find that we can express the scaling for all of these, so this exponent that for of n that we have to rescale all the diagrams with, as 3 × 1/2 is 3 × the number of tensor pairs minus the number of faces that appear in this graph. And that is straightforward to show it for these Melonic graphs. But then, and this is a little bit more work, but you can also show by graphical means that this ansatz is consistent with a 1 over n expandability for all beta functions. So this means not just for cyclic melons or not just for Melonic graphs, but for all these tensor invariants that we can write down. So this is the the scaling that we have to impose, or this is a consistent scaling that we have to impose. So in the first paper that I wrote with Astrid about this, we considered a T2D6 truncation, which is here, and we found, we applied the same thing as we did to the matrix models, and we found this system of beta functions. And of course, this system of beta functions is not manageable in any reasonable way. And we investigated, as a first step, numerically what the fixed points are. But it's really, if you go about it like this, if you look only at fixed points without classifying them, you don't understand what the physics is. You don't understand what the physics is of this model. Well, let me just give you a rundown of what you can do with that. Well, you find a ton of fixed points for this model and for various models. We have by now considered pure tensor models, or real and complex, and up to T2D8 truncations. We've considered mainly with Joseph Benchelun tensor field theories, and with Alicia, who is there in the seminar, we have worked on a one plus one dimensional matrix model that through dual weights implements a foliation in the matrix model. And in each case, except in the dually weighted model, the truncation is a little smaller, but in each case we found fixed points. In each of the other cases we found fixed points with enhanced symmetry. So for example, if I have an ON to the third model, so this the real model with where I have for in symmetry, then there will always be fixed points that have enhanced symmetry where, for example, two of the indices fuse together and I have an ON squared ON model, or even an ON to the third model. And so these types of fixed points, they turn out that have this enhanced symmetry, they turn out to not have an interpretation in terms of a geometric interpretation in terms of a three-dimensional geometry, basically because when you go back to this here, it means that, for example, this blue and green index in these diagrams, that they fuse to one index, and then they behave basically as an anisotropic matrix index, the joint indices. Then, of course, in any kind of truncation, you have truncation artifacts. This is that there appear spurious zeros of simultaneous zeros of all the beta functions, but they are just there because you haven't included all the operators that can backcouple into this truncation, and so which would be generated by the truncation and can backcouple into this truncation. And since this never ends, you always have to systematically enlarge your truncation and see whether to check for a truncation artifact. But recently, in about the last year, we found several fixed points that have no enhanced symmetry, and that where we haven't found any indications that they're artifacts of truncations. So these are at least candidates for continuum limits that might have a geometric interpretation. So there is, of course, a lot to be done with these models. In particular, there is one direction that we want to work on in the near future, which is to work on dually weighted models, so models with a modified propagator and therefore a modified ward identity. And these models are necessary to model to have a tensor model representation of CDTs or EDTs, basically how you get a preferred foliation, like in the 1+1 case, or how you get the volume term for the partition function in EDTs for this case. So with that, I hope I'm not too much over time. Well, let me just summarize. The motivation for all of this was to explore the continuum limit of discrete models of quantum gravity. Initially, more than 10 years ago, I was motivated by loop quantum gravity, where you have this discrete kinematic notion of geometry, and then of course you want to understand how does continuum geometry come out of this. And I argued that by doing, when you take these tensor models in their own right, so models of discrete geometry in the tensor model language, by its in their own right, then the functional renormalization group equation is a standalone approach, due to the fact that it's a tool to construct one of these cylindrically consistent measures that implements the symmetries that we need to have a geometric interpretation. Then I reviewed some of the matrix model results. I didn't mention there is one of the first benchmark tests that I did a long time ago with Alessandro Sfondrini, was that you can use the FRG In dem Matrix-Model approach to the Große Wolkenhaar-Model, das ist a four-dimensional non-commutative phi to the four model, which was known by 2011, 2010 when we did the calculations to be asymptotically safe, and then we found this asymptotic safety exactly with the functional renormalization group equation. Then we, as I mentioned in this talk, you can do this. You can use the FRG to find the double scaling limit and multi-critical points for pure matrix models, and you can. And if you implement the symmetry of the model, then you can also achieve high numerical accuracy of of the critical exponents. So you have not just an exploratory tool, but a real tool to investigate the phenomenology of these quantum gravity models, because the phenomena are all encoded in the critical exponents. I mentioned the importance of symmetry, and also what I hope I made clear is that the once you understand exactly how to do this for matrix models, you can do it. You can apply this setup for tensor models as its own approach to tensor models. So you can use the FRG to find possible continuum limits, to find possible non-Gaussian measures for tensor models that have certain symmetries. And of course, there's a lot of work that needs to be done in this. And well, I stop here and thank you for your attention.
Tim?
Yeah. So Tim, could
Yes.
you? So you mentioned that certain fixed points are just truncation artifacts, but is it possible that you could lose a fixed point when you impose the flowing ordered energy, or?
Yes, in principle, this is in principle possible. In general, and this is something if you imagine you're in this theory space here, and a ordered entity is a surface in this theory space. So in principle, you can have a fixed point that lies here outside this this where the ordered entity is satisfied, and that is so this is a non-symmetric fixed point, so that can happen. However, what is usually it's the other way around. So usually you find fixed points using symmetry. So very often, and this is simply due to the fact that symmetries cut down the theory space, and due to the fact that the flow preserves the ordered entity, you can you the relevant part of the flow is restricted to a smaller space. So it's usually more likely that in a more symmetric case you find a fixed point.
I see.
But in general, it's true that you might not have a fixed point because of symmetry. There's another aspect to that, and this is this the issue that I went through twice with the scaling of the operators. And this scaling of the operators appears here in front of the as this prefactor. Sorry, as this prefactor here. And this is of course very important for all the beta functions to vanish simultaneously. This prefactor is important there. And so there could be different theory spaces that have nominally the same type of interactions, but due to different scaling, have a different fixed point structure. However, I have to caution that we have not found a different scaling that is consistent. I only say this for completeness because it's a logical possibility.
Thanks. Any other questions? So, Tim, I just would like to ask, in tensor models, usually what you hear is that melonic graphs are dominating this 1/n expansion. Can you say anything about possible phases of tensor models using the FRG?
Actually, what we found is also that melonic graphs appear as the most important ones, and they appear basically in the rank 3 case because they have the smallest scaling dimensions. So they are the most important operators in your theory space. So if you think about it in the structure of the beta functions, well, let me just go give you this here. You have these the four melonic, and you have the four disconnected graphs, for example. And you have one time you have the n to the n squared scaling, and one time you have the n to the third scaling. It is so this whole thing can be negative, and this is good. So this coupling is never turned on. But for this coupling to have to take a non-Gaussian value, to have a non-vanishing non-Gaussian value, you have to compensate for this 2 here, basically. And this is easier to achieve if you have a small number than you have a large number. When you have a large number, it's just more, you just need larger values for all of this, and then it's numerically less stable and so on. So in this sense, you find the same wisdom, but there is one caution. What usually people who talk, people from the TensorTrack program, what they talk about is the melonic Feynman diagrams. And the melonic Feynman diagrams, they are actually the diagrams that survive at the first order in the 1/n expansion. And when you look at the functional renormalization group equation, it's just a one loop equation. And something that happens in the here at one loop is also for a much simpler diagrammatic reason is that the melonic diagrams dominate. And this is basically if we go back to these interactions here. If you do the second variation and you have two free index lines and you combine a string of them, then you will always, in a one loop string, you combine a bunch of them, then you will have two free index lines that are completely contracted, and that gives you an enhancement of n squared. So these are the terms that are most likely to survive in the large n limit. And all the other terms where you don't contract, where I contract over only one of these indices in the one loop expansion, they will usually be suppressed by powers of n. And that is very similar to the that is actually the same thing as the melonic dominance in the Feynman diagrams, just at one loop. So the trade-off is we just have to look at one loop, but we have to include all possible interactions. But in a sense, you see the same thing happening. The reason why melons are dominating is the technical reason is this, or the superficial reason is this, that you have more free indices to contract over.
Okay, thank you. And I think there are no more questions, so let us thank Tim again.